Good morning. Is that the Emperor?
It is indeed.
Oh, great. This is Arnaldo, your humble servant from Cows Radio in Sonoma County. Thank you very much for the interview.
No problem.
You know, I was born and raised in England, and you were a great influence on me because of that.
A good influence, I hope.
I think so, because it sort of made me more anti-establishment, I would say.
Well, you could have picked Jimmy Savile as your idol.
Exactly.
So at least you made the wise choice.
I think so, yes. So actually, it's quite a fortuitous time. You've got your book and the edition to, and part two is coming out very soon, isn't it?
Well, the problem is now, you see, with the Savile thing, all DJs are tarnished with a bad brush in the UK, so it's a very bad time to bring it out, so we'll probably wait 6 months.
Oh, really? Do you think it has that much of an impact?
Oh, God, you should see the emails flying around.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Well, I know, I used to go to, Top of the Pops, you know, just as in the crowd, you know, with friends. And I know the girls all used to tell me about him, you know, just we have to stay away from him. He's real bad, you know, so it definitely was well known even in the 60s.
Yeah. Well, the rumors were pretty rampant.
Yeah. A couple of years ago when Pirate Radio came out here, we had a special showing at our cinema as a benefit for our station, and people loved it, and the whole concept of Pirate Radio, and, you know, they still talk about it now, you know, 2 years later. It was a very exciting thing. It really piqued people's imagination, and being there must have been an incredible thing. Let's go way back. Can you give us some of your background, how you got to be there? I know you were in the Navy at the time in the early 60s. How did that all fall into place? You got there and then suddenly you became a radio pirate.
My career started in the military. If you saw Good Morning Vietnam.
Yes.
Well, I did the naval version of that, if you will.
Okay.
So that was giving me a lot of training. I was the coffee boy at KYA Radio in San Francisco, just hanging around the mega stars and absorbing the knowledge. And I took all that with me when I was sent to France to work for Barclay Records. And whilst I was at Barclay Records, I failed miserably as a producer because I'm turned deaf. So he said, well, listen, we have to do something with you. We've shipped you over here. So why don't we put you in charge of our radio shows? I said, fine. And he used to buy, like the old days of Radio Luxembourg, he would buy 30-minute chunks here and there, and it would be, I could play anything, that I wanted out of his catalog. So I was, like, doing my weird stuff and putting it in his shows, and they became so popular that he didn't have to pay for them anymore, so he was thrilled to bits. They said, as long as this guy Roscoe is, you know, doing the shows, we'll take them. And I went from small stations to medium stations to the big number one station in France, at which point Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs blew into town, and I was introducing the bands at the big venues in those days. And the manager said, well, why don't you, join Radio Caroline? I'm a good friend of Ronan O'Reilly, the boss. And there I was. I'm 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm saying, you're leaving tomorrow. How am I going to make this connection? So he said, listen, just make me a tape. I'll take it over there. So I went 2 o'clock in the morning. I went to the studio and cut a tape, gave it to him at his hotel. I left it for collection. He took it back to Ronan. Ronan O'Reilly called me up about a week later and said, we need you on the ship. I said, ooh, okay. I mean, this is how simple it was.
Yeah.
And I jumped in my car and said goodbye to France and went to Radio Caroline.
Well, and, with a boat in between, not just your car.
You get to Felixstowe and you jump on a trawler, and then the trawler would sail for an hour out to sea, and you would transfer at sea onto the Mi Amigo, which was, compared to the movie, an absolute rust bucket. I mean, the movie was luxurious compared to the real pirate ship.
Oh, dear.
And I was there for a year, you know, 2 weeks on, 1 week off. And Ronan made a connection back in France with Radio Luxembourg, the French one, which was like a million watts of power covering all of Europe. And he basically said, listen, I've sold you to Radio Luxembourg. Yeah, I've sold your contract. You're going back to France and represent me there. So I converted Radio Luxembourg to the first ever DJ plays music rather than an engineer plays music. Mm. We built a DJ studio. And the show became number one. For the first time, that station was number one in 40 years, you know, whatever. So it was all, those were the all heady days where there was more money than sense and this, that, and the other. And I was there until the revolution in France of 68. Oh, at yes. which point I was on tape on Radio 1, and I said, listen, I'm coming over, I'll do it live, I'm getting out of this place, it's crazy. And joined Radio 1, and you know what happened ever since. And now, of course, we syndicate worldwide.
Well, that's it.
We might even be on your station one day.
Hey, you may hear the move from Cowles.
You know, if you can rub a few matchsticks together and light a fire under management, we'll...
That time when you went to Caroline, you know, for me, on the other side of the wireless, listening, you know, to what was coming out from the ships in England, in London, you know, it was miraculous for the baby boomer teenagers at that time. We'd never heard anything like it, and especially you. Your, you know, American-style radio we'd never heard before. And did you realize that? You know, how
we took all you virgins and turned you upside down. What can I tell you? But it, no, that's what the phenomenon was all about. We went from zero listenership to something like 23 million in a week. I mean, that was the popularity of the ship when it kicked off. So it was quite amazing. Had they had a signal like the BBC, it would have been, you know, 100 million people listening.
Oh, absolutely. It was a phenomenon, and I thought the film Pirate Radio really captured that on the other side, you know, the wireless, people's joy at listening to the station.
That part of it was correct, yes, but there were no women on the ship. There were, you know, there were a lot of things they put in there for, you know, movie reasons.
Sure. And tell us, what was a day on the life on a pirate boat? Can you give us an idea what that would have been
like? You know, everybody has a different, you know, way of working. When I went out there, it was just, I just zoned in on the ship and the show, and nothing else really mattered. Maybe 1 hour of fishing once in a while. Poker game once in a while, but other than that, you focused 100% on how to better everything, how to kick ass with the opposition, which was Radio England and Radio London and the Forts, and of course the BBC. And we were not against sabotaging the other ships or you know, stealing stuff from the BBC and pirating it. We were pirates, after all.
Exactly.
So anything that worked, you know, they didn't show you anything in the movie about the real, you know, conniptions that we got up to, like stealing all the jingles off Radio England before they actually went on the air when they were test transmitting.
Oh, no.
We taped them all, and then we cut Radio Caroline in where Radio England was because they had all these expensive Pam jingles.
Oh, no.
And we went on the air with their jingles before they did, and that caused all kinds of an uproar. You know, that type of thing, you know.
Oh, I love it. Tell me more. As you say, it was just guys. You were on, what, 2 weeks and 1 week off?
That was the general, unless weather prevailed. Of course, sometimes you'd end up being there for 3 weeks. Storm brewing or something. Of course, when the waves were too much, the needle would slide across the record.
Oh, that's...
Back in those days, for your young people, we had black things that looked like pancakes. They were called 45s and had grooves in them, and this needle would roll along the groove, and that's how the music was transmitted. But, of course, if the angle would shift with the wave, it would go right across, and, of course, that was not very good radio, even though we allowed it to happen once just to let everybody know that we were you know, in a big storm. And then we would switch to two tape recorders, and there would be pre-recorded stuff on the tapes, and we would talk live over the tapes. Well, in those days, those were heady days. You know, everybody was a superstar because of the magnitude of the audiences.
Well, that's true when you counted millions. Now, how did you select the music you played? Was it just your own personal likes, or were you dictated to? How did that work on your show?
Well, we were told, we were basically stay within the top 40. You could add stuff if you did it in good taste. Ronan O'Reilly was more for the spirit of the free broadcast than he was for... We didn't have to worry about it. We had no opposition to speak of. So, you know, unless you're playing something very stupid, you know, you got away with it okay. Now, this was okay until Ronan got into financial trouble and sold out a big chunk of the station to a guy called Phil Solomons, who ran Major Minor Records. Phil, not being stupid, said, listen, if I buy a chunk of this, then I want you to play my records on major, you know, from my record label. And he had people like The Bachelors and Zena Zavaroni and, you know, people that were totally out of format for us.
Yeah.
And the other guys who cared, of course, they would play it. And whenever I would sit in there, if I saw one of those records in the studio, it would go right out the porthole, like a frisbee. And because I got fired every 2 weeks, you know, for doing that. But then Ronan would hire me back again. So Phil and I actually got along pretty good in the end, but, I mean, he used to absolutely blow his stack when I would come ashore and show up at the office, and he'd go cursing up a storm with his big cigar and everything. I'd say, Phil, I'm not playing crap. I don't care. I said, as a matter of fact, if I see them, I throw them off, because with the whole station shouldn't be playing that crap.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously that's the rebel in me that's been swimming upstream for a long, long time. And in the end, he hired me as a producer.
Oh, okay.
To try and get around it. I made a couple of good records for him, but that's where that ended. And that's, yeah. So I don't know how we got on that subject. Oh, yeah, you asked me what we played.
Yeah, well, obviously what we loved as fans was when, you know, the BBC was always banning records, and, of course, you would play them immediately and all the time.
That made them better.
Ronan O'Reilly, what a legend he is. Can you give us your, you know, interaction with him, what you felt of him?
Ronan and I got along great because we're both kind of rebel spirits. And he just last week got an award in England for something from somebody for being the first to, you know, do the spirit of radio. I don't know. I just saw a picture in the paper of him. So I think at least he's still alive.
Oh, good.
He lives in Chelsea.
But yeah, what a hero to keep going like that, you know. That is,
well, he was going to try, and at one point when they finally banned the pirates, he was going to broadcast off an aeroplane. He was going to put a big air tanker in the air over Britain. I guess that didn't work out so well. But they're still on. They're still on today. You know, they're online.
That's right. Yeah, I occasionally listen, you know, in. And
they have about 28 disc jockeys, I think. Each one doing a half hour or something silly. I don't know.
Now, I got this great, you know, obviously you dropped into the whole London scene at the time, which was going on, and obviously contributed to it. And I love the bit about you hosting the, emceeing the Stax Vault Tour in London at the Astoria. Mm-hmm. What a special thing. I remember Otis being on Ready, Steady, Go during that tour.
Mm-hmm.
What a great tour that must have been to be.
Oh, they don't make them like that anymore. You don't get 10, 12 superstars, you know, all in one show. And that's what that was all about. And, of course, it was introducing live soul music to the UK, which was new and novel at the time as well.
The pirates went away, and, you know, by the new law. And how was it going to the BBC? You had a sort of a buffer because you did it recorded, first of all. But how was that going over to the enemy like that? How did you
manage? It felt a little funny at first. But then again, all the pirates were there, you know, except for Jimmy Young and a few strange people that they kept on radio once as not to shock the public too much, I think. you know, when we started, everybody was, you know, doing 1 or 2 hours. You know, they started with 25 DJs and then whittled them down little by little. And it was, you know, once again, I was able to play what I wanted. The producers were quite happy. I guess I'm a natural programmer, so I was one of the ones that, you know, they didn't even bother giving me a program. You know, they, I mean, they give me a rough list and say, all right, yeah, here's the show. And of course, I will. I would listen to every single that was released, both sides, every week, which numbered in the hundreds. Mm. And came up with a lot of B-sides that became hits. So they respected that, I think.
Can you tell us about what you've been doing since then? I know you've, you were at the BBC for quite a time, but then really since then, now with the age of the internet, what are you doing? I know you're still broadcasting all over the world.
I was one of the first guys on the planet to do mobile music, which was...
Oh, this
way back then. I think I saw Dave Lee Travis, who had a couple of turntables put together with Band-Aids and a couple of faders. And he said, oh, you know, I take this to the ballrooms and I play music. And I went, oh, yeah, okay. It's a great idea. So I went and did it the American way, which is, you know, bigger, better, and light shows and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, this is really neat. I'm going to have movie screen behind me and show movies, and we invented the Roscoe Roadshow, and that was the first professional, you know, full-time, really driving around the country, which I still do here, not so often anymore, because people down in California, they're quite happy with two small speakers and little background music. They're not into the raucous type of you know, UK kind of parties that we used to do.
Right.
But that's still going on, so there's that. And there's the, like you say, Roscoe World Syndications, which is made fresh every week and sent out. We do a country show, country music, but we tend to do rock country rather than, you know, bluegrass country. Hmm. So we're staying very busy and doing what I do.
One thing I always ask you, because you're semi-British in a way, because being there, did you...
Very kind of you, old chap.
You know. did you ever take a liking for tea? Or did you see...
Tea? Or only under duress and only when there was no coffee available.
Okay.
It was very kind of you to think of this. Oh. I'm an old age pensioner now.
Oh, that's... I know. It's somehow...
But just don't tell anybody. Which is really nice about DJs. You see, we can hide behind the microphone. Nobody knows.
Exactly.
As long as the voice doesn't break, you're in good shape. May your voice rule the southern coast of California, sir.
Thank you so much, Mike Pasternak, Emperor Roscoe.
Well, you stay out of trouble.